Welcome to the Because Church Suite podcast. We believe innovation is a part of the solution to alleviating poverty. So we're going to be talking to some pretty interesting people from all over the world doing some pretty innovative things. Our hope is that the conversations will inspire you to creatively pursue being the church where you live and where you may go. The content of each episode is geared towards our Church Suite partners, but could be helpful to anyone a part of the church, and especially those of you leading or pastoring. If you'd like to partner with us through our VBS mission project, our youth ministry series called Shoebox, by distributing the shoe that grows through a trip or in your church's efforts with Operation Christmas Child, please let us know by reaching out at becauseinternational.org. For now, enjoy this podcast episode and remember that small things can make a big difference.
I think Jesus would say, those are the stories you wrote down? That's not what I told you guys.
This is the best you can come up with?
In the Bible is totally ridiculous. The whole scene with the children, you got that completely wrong. I also was speaking sternly to them.
why'd you edit me? This is way later down to the questions, but I just jump all around. I was at the National Youth Workers Convention and work in the booth. And booth work, it's like, awesome. It's feast and famine. And I always feel like the booth has so much better opportunity when I'm not at it. And I just sit like 20 feet away and I just watch. People interact with the booth more when I'm not there. I don't know what the connection is, but I was thinking about how I heard you talk about the 12 in one ministry. Do you remember that? Where you wanted to set up a table at a, do you remember what I'm talking about?
I think you do. I used to talk about youth ministry. If you have 12 kids and one wants to kill you.
Yeah, but you're like, if I'm going to go to one of these conventions, I'm going to just set up a table, no sign up sheet or anything, and I'm going to offer the 12 in one
to kill you ministries. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you'd ask him questions like, they say, what is this? Well, let me ask you some questions. Do the kids in your youth ministry, do they want to kill you? Do they misunderstand you all the time and they don't really know what you're talking about, even though you re-explain it to them? Right. They just don't get it. Yeah. Do you feel like they're conspiring and whispering behind your back and they're trying to maybe do away, all these qualifiers. And then I think if I remember right, you'd say, well, then you're blessed and your ministry is blessed. Yeah. You're walking in the ways
God's
of Christ.
Ministry. That's right. That's right.
That's right. I've thought about that many.
I think I said that like 8-10 years ago at a youth specialties event. One person was listening.
I got it. And now seven people that listen to this are going to get it too. And then the guerrilla tactics will just expand from there.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to officially start this with my weird questions?
You know, I just glanced at all your questions really quickly. I thought it'd probably be better if I didn't prepare. Maybe then you're going to find out later. Hey, next time, I can only please prepare.
No, I anticipated that. We're right where we want to be.
Okay, good.
Right where we want to be. So I call these first responder questions. So I just say the word or phrase or the either or option, and then you just tell me what you're thinking about it.
Okay.
There's like 10 of them.
Oh God, this is going to take forever. There's going to be these long silences.
You know what? The last time I did this, it was 15 minutes.
Okay. I'll try not to take that long.
But it was mostly me talking, so I'll try not to. Okay. So here we go. Pumpkin spice.
There's no pumpkin in it.
Agreed.
I'm just like one phrase, one word is all I'm doing, right?
Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do.
But why are you pausing for such a long time after my response? That feels like a judgment.
I don't know. It's not a judgment. I was thinking about not responding, and then I did anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's try it again.
I don't follow my rules.
Let's just start all over again. And this time we're just going to hit them one at a time and it's going to have this great rhythm to it. Okay. Say the first one again.
Pumpkin spice.
There's lots of pumpkin in it.
Mission trip.
Sleeping on the ground.
Snacks.
No thanks.
Pet.
They always die.
Wow. Air travel.
A place for solitude and creative thinking.
A workout.
No, thanks.
That was my guess for what your answer was going to be, Mark. Technology.
Makes me sad. You're bringing me down. This was going to be a fun time.
No, it's good.
These prompts.
This is perfect. Christmas music.
I have a Christmas soul album that we play every year that makes me really happy. I love that album. It was made in the 50s and 60s, and it's just great, great tune.
Is it on vinyl?
It was on vinyl. We put it on cassette. Mm-hmm. People don't even know what that is. Cassette is a new thing Apple's putting out next year.
That's right.
Those under 30.
I can't wait for it. Early adopter. Two more. This is really quick. This is the quickest these questions have ever gone.
Excellent.
Two more. Vegan pizza.
Cauliflower crust is actually quite good.
Okay, last one. Baby Yoda.
Makes my daughter extremely happy.
Well, see, that one I thought Mark is either he's going to know or not know, but he'll have
to. I only know things like that. I have a 16-year-old daughter, and she shows me these things. And she loves to look at Baby Yoda. I did her every once in a while. It's like dad's education time. And so like I showed her all the Star Wars films. We watched them over like a week long. I said, you have to know this. And so now she knows who Yoda is and she loves Baby Yoda.
That's awesome. Okay. That was it. That was our warm up. Like we needed one.
That's it. This has been a great podcast. That was excellent.
It's been good. Okay, have a great day. Have a good Christmas. We'll talk in 10 years. It'll be good. How we first met. I remember this pretty vividly. There's a story behind it. It was at a Sabbath retreat at San Francisco Theological Seminary. And I got really reflective at National Youth Workers because that's where I was first introduced to spiritual direction. I think I told you this last time we talked on the phone, but my mentor went to spiritual direction and the Sabbath retreats were being promoted. They were just offered their spiritual direction. And you know, they still have spiritual direction going. And it was just cool to see that as a part of the conference and just worked in, and they've added coaching and some different things, but it was just fun to see that. But from that, I ended up at one of these Sabbath weekends and retreats that you were running at San Francisco Theological Seminary.
They were 5-day retreats. I can't even imagine asking anyone to do a 5-day retreat. I think people would feel insulted, like, who the heck has 5 days? You know what I mean? Like, no one asks anybody to do that anymore. People are like, I'm so busy, I could not even take 1 day, much less 5.
But but with vacation, I mean, it takes me like 2 or 3 days to get into vacation, kind of let stuff go. And I realized that with those retreats, was it took you a few days to kind of get there, kind of be there.
Now, I don't even know if anything like that exists anywhere, particularly for youth workers. But I mean, there's a couple I know about, but you know, monasteries are dying. I mean, it just, people who are listening to this have probably tuned out, but they don't even know what we're talking about, a Sabbath retreat. This was a contemplative retreat where you would spend the morning in silence. These were youth workers hyped up on 32-ounce Cokes and corn nuts. And they would come to this retreat and they'd be in silence all morning. We did no name tags. We did no mixers. We did no get to know who people are. And then we would kind of do a spiritual practice. We'd teach them. Then we'd do it in the morning, another spiritual practice in the afternoon. Then they had to meet in a small group with a spiritual director, a little closing prayer, and that was it. We used to call a retreat about nothing. There was almost nothing happening at this retreat. And so people would sleep. Yeah, they would take a lot of naps. They'd fall asleep during the spiritual practices. And
it was great.
Yeah, and I remember one spiritual director saying, a lot of people think they're meeting God here, but I think they're just getting rested.
Yeah.
And there's probably, you know, but God is the very first definition of prayer among the Desert Fathers was rest. That was the etymology of the word prayer meant rest. And maybe they're the same thing in some ways.
I found it intriguing being a part of those, how, I don't know if we noticed it or you kind of shared it with us, that there would be people that would leave. They wouldn't tell anybody. They'd be there 1 day, maybe 2 days, and then they would just be gone. And they left. And they couldn't, I don't know if not being able to handle it was the right way to say it, but in the silence or feeling like they were being unproductive, like what was some of the What were some of the observations you made with that?
Well, first of all, anytime I speak or lead an event, people leave. So I realize it's just me. But during, this is terrible. This is much worse than I thought it could be. I didn't realize this would be that bad. I'm leaving.
That's exactly what I wanted.
But, Jesus meets the accuser once he goes out in the desert, in the silence and the solitude. Mm. And so people would say, oh, a Sabbath retreat, you know, gosh, I've been working too much. I feel harried. I feel, fragmented. I need a nice, calm retreat. And they would come and they'd be in silence. They'd get rest. They'd do these silent prayers. And all the crap inside themselves would come to the surface. All the repressed anger, all the unmet longings, you know, all the hurt shows up once you sort of slow down. So that's one of the reasons we'd never want to slow down in this culture, is because there's so much down there that we're afraid of. And I think that's what happened. People would get chased out of those retreats by all that was unhealed within them, and they would just make a run for it.
Hmm. Well, and this is where I learned the phrase busyness is laziness.
Yeah, that's actually, this is the fun part. I love this game that happens now that I'm over 50s, because I have no idea where how to find words, and I don't know what I might say, bear or turkey. I don't know what's in my mouth right now. What is his name? We all know this guy's name. Who wrote who did the message?
Eugene Peterson.
Eugene Peterson said this. Yeah. It was so funny because, you know, in the 90s, I was just talking to, this will get some hits. I was just talking to Anne Lamott, you know, the writer Anne Lamott?
Yeah.
And we were laughing about how in the 80s and 90s, everyone was talking about how we were too busy. How we were just, and there were all these books coming out on busyness and people living hyperactive lives and the way television was taking over. And of course, now we look back, it looks like Norman Rockwell times. It looks like, you know, the 80s and 90s do. But, you know, you had someone like Eugene Peterson in the 80s and 90s just saying, we are moving at the speed of light. We're moving way too fast. We have to slow down. Busyness is laziness. And of course, now it looks so leisurely compared to these 24-hour phones, you know.
Yeah. Well, I've shared that phrase over the years quite a few times. And it's like playing telephone with these phrases. Like, you heard Eugene Peterson say it, and then you shared it at the Sabbath retreat, and then Kenny heard it, and then I've messed it up a lot. But what I tell people is, because it's harder to slow down and be present to God and those that were around us and that we're gifted with, like our family, than it is just to stay busy all the time. It's a lot easier just to stay busy than it is to slow down. Busyness is laziness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's true. It continues to be true.
Well, I mean, but those things, Mark, and I hope out of our conversations, you're encouraged too, because those things that you shared, that you did, I mean, those still shape and form me in really good, healthy, holistic, and fun ways and inspiring ways. I first walked a prayer labyrinth at the Sabbath retreat. Mm-hmm. And it was just candles, and it was just this invitation. There wasn't a whole lot of explanation around it. It was just very basic. Like, this is what this is. If you like to do this, this is how to spend the time. It was meaningful for me. And then I've had the opportunity to set that up for people, and was able to get one made in our area. We went to Home Depot and had this canvas company.
Yeah.
Like, you know, sew them all together, and then had college students, art students paint on the design as one of their projects in class. And so it was a budget labyrinth, but it's got the lines in the path and you can see it, and it's fine. And you walk, and we just hosted this for a group of young adults and older youth and youth leaders at a thing we call the Call Conference, connected with the university here. And it's a small retreat of folks. It's, you know, it's 50 or 60 people. And they have this option to come walk that in their groups. And it was a joy to share that. And so I'm one of the people that from Sabbath retreats, and there's others, I'm not really sure who they are. I know a couple of them. there's two other, at least two others that I know personally, that those things impacted me. But the way, like, I knew you, I knew who you were facilitating this thing, and we had spiritual directors and you were part of that. And it was just, it was cool. It was this great weekend. It was really hard work at doing nothing, drawing closer to Jesus, and then going back and fleshing out home. But how we really met, I felt like we had this poignant moment was, this is the true part of the story. I went to use one of the bathrooms in the dorm that I was staying in, and the previous person had not flushed the toilet.
That's important to tell now.
And so I flushed the toilet before I was going to use it. Mm-hmm. And the toilet overflowed. Now, I feel like, as I've brought this story up over the years, you've disputed whether or not that was the actual chain of events that happened. But fact is, toilet overflowed, and I mentioned it to somebody, and I said, hey, let Mark know or something. And then I came and found you. Do you remember this?
Yeah, you may have called me, something like that. I think I was at home. And I put on rubber boots. I remember putting on rubber boots.
That's right.
Walking you put them across on. The campus.
In your house, thinking, and you put these on. Yeah, we're walking across campus because you lived right there on the campus, right?
Yeah, I lived on campus. And so it's like, oh, man, I got to go fix this toilet, which is the real work of, you know, being a spiritual teacher.
That's right.
Sometimes I run into spiritual directors and stuff, and they're like, who's going to set up the rooms? And it's like, if you're not really setting up the rooms and clearing up the toilets, then I question your spirituality.
That's like, right.
Yes, that's you and I met. I remember that. We were in a place called Baird Hall. I remember we were in the, I remember there was water all over the floor in the men's.
Well, back up a little bit because we got the galoshes on, and we're going across to the campus here, and it's getting dark. It's not quite dark yet, but it's getting dark. And I'm just thinking, here's this guy that I saw at this really big conference, and now I'm at the Sabbath retreat thing, and he's in charge of this thing, and this is like what he's doing with his vocation and life, and he's the guy that's got galoshes. I didn't know why he put galoshes on. I was like, this is intense. Like, I've never seen anybody clean a toilet. Like, they're gonna, you know, unclog the toilet with galoshes. And then we get to the dorm, and you're looking for a place to find like a mop and like tools for cleaning, for unclogging a toilet. Do you remember what happened? Do you remember you went to a door, you thought it was the utility closet, and you opened it up, and it was actually somebody's room, and you already taken a step in. Do you not remember that?
No.
I do, and here's why. You're like, oh, excuse me, I'm so sorry. It's the wrong door, and you pulled it shut, and you turned, and you looked right at me, and you said, I'm going to blame that on you. He's like, and then you're like, where's the closet at? And you find the closet. And now we're in the bathroom, and I should be helping. I should have the mop. I should be doing stuff. And I'm just talking, kind of like I'm doing right now. Yeah. And you're just mopping, and you're just listening. You're just being a great spiritual director while you're doing the spiritual holy work, you know? And I remember getting done, and it's like, Mark just cleaned up that mess that wasn't mine. But now I can use the facilities. That's great. He just took the time to do that. And there's all these little funny moments in there. But the takeaway for me was just really your heart and your spirit in it and your attentiveness in the middle of doing a rather unpleasant task.
I'm glad. I'm sure there's plenty other stories of times I used four-letter words and was a complete jerk. And so I'm glad that worked out. Of course, you know, at the time, you were not a parent, I don't think, back then.
No.
But I was.
No, actually, I was. A young parent. Young parents.
Yeah, so I was used to, you know, this is the work of parenting. Once, you know, that's the real spiritual novitiate, is having kids, and toilets becomes a big part of your life.
Big time.
That's right.
Never stops.
Yeah.
Man. Well, there was when did those Sabbath retreats start? When did you start hosting those?
So those started in 19, I want to say, well, maybe it was 1995, something like that. 96. It might have been 96. 6, 9, 10. Yeah, it was like 95 or 96. So it was early. I was a new convert to all this spirituality stuff. And it had saved my life. It had helped me see a different face of God. And, you know, of course, I had grown up in this hyperactive youth ministry culture that was full of, you know, I was in the wake of my dad's insights, which were, this should be fun. This should be full of activity. This should be full of laughter and play. And, you know, and that kind of went crazy, you know, where it became, when I used to go to the first youth specialties conventions back in the 70s as a little kid, it was super homegrown, super funky. You know, it'd be like going to a, well, you know, we have cannabis is legal here. You're like going to a cannabis convention. It was like everybody had long hair and, you know, they were trying to figure stuff. They were photocopying, mimeographing songs together. And my dad and Wayne Rice, they would run these conventions, but you're talking about 300 people maybe there. And they'd say, hey, anybody got a song or a skit or something cool you're doing, come and meet in this room. And then they would audition. And so they would play their song or they would say, well, I want to tell people about this cool discussion I'm doing with kids in my youth group. And they would listen to it. And then my dad and Wayne would decide, okay, well, we'll have this guy speak tonight. And this guy will do a song tomorrow night. And this guy will, and they would just kind of create it on the fly right there. I mean, they'd have some stuff planned ahead of time, but they'd choose a lot of things that were right there. And it was really homegrown. And it was kind of a crack up. I mean, meeting at a hotel was a joke. You know, now it's just seen like that's what you're supposed to do. But it was kind of like, wouldn't it be hilarious if youth workers, like we all stayed in a really nice hotel and figured this out? Since people were kind of getting back to the land in the 70s and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then it became very, you know, I remember some of the last conversations I had with my dad was that it became very consumeristic. He said, this is a monster. I created a monster that I can't control anymore. And it became very porous to the surrounding culture. So I was in that world. And to me, like the most radical thing that I could do was be silent or, you know, to be in solitude. That seemed like a radical kind of contradiction to what the youth ministry world had turned into. And it was also where my dad was also going in terms of his own spiritual life. He was reading Henry Nouwen and hanging out with Brent.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. And so I was converted by this stuff. And then like a new convert, I really wanted to share it. And I was really militant in those early years. Like I was, like I would run it and I got my dad to help run it, but neither of us would take any money for it. We'd pay the spiritual directors that, you know, youth specialties helped sponsor it, but they weren't allowed to make any profit off of it. I was just really about, this thing is going to be pure. And I got the seminary to donate the space and we're going to keep
pricing. Wow.
And anybody calls us, they can't afford it. We're going to find a way to get the money. And that's kind of how we ran it for a long time. And, you know, then things change.
it was run on a grant, wasn't it? The Youth Ministry and Spirituality Project?
My project was run on a grant, yeah. Sabbath thing was something separate because I was trying to figure out how do I get this conversation around silence, solitude, prayer, meditation, being present to God. How do I work that into the youth ministry world? And the reason I wanted to work it there is so that young people would encounter it early on in their Christian life. And it would become a series of tools and practices that they could access the rest of their lives. So they would see this more generous, more accessible face of God. And that was the hope, is I got to get youth ministers, just like you said, you did the Labyrinth, and then you went and took it to your context and people began to do the Labyrinth. That was the whole plan. But it couldn't be through a series of books or workshops. People had to be transformed. So we wanted them to have these deep immersive experiences where they were converted. And then we just trusted they'll figure out ways to bring it back. We don't have
to do that. Well, so we have.
Yeah. People have taken it and they've done all kinds of things with it. But in those days, I didn't want anybody to write a book about it. So I prevented youth specialties from writing books as best I could about that stuff. You know, I just like different people would come to those retreats and they'd say, hey, we should do a book on spiritual practices. And I would say, no. And I would tell my dad, do not let anybody write a book about this. And then Group Magazine, you remember Group? Is Group still around?
Yeah, they are.
They actually sent, I mean, this is a little shaky, but they sent people to those retreats to learn what I was doing and then write books about it. And
really?
So two different times at the end of those 5-day retreats, they sent two different people two different times. Somebody came to me at the end and said, I'm actually here kind of undercover. Like I was sent by group and told I needed to come and to learn what you were doing and then write a book about this. And they were just like, I feel really guilty about this because I'm a writer.
Good.
You know? And I said, well, and I would just say, don't do it. And then the next person, because I thought as long as no one writes, because as soon as somebody writes about it, it's like, oh yeah, I got that book on spiritual practices, whatever.
Yeah.
But as long as it was stayed a kind of a secret, you would have to go and actually do it. And that was the power of it. So that's how I was in the beginning years. And, you know, I remember Tony Jones. Remember this guy, Tony Jones?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, he wrote a grant and the grant was so that he would come to the Sabbath retreat, learn what I was doing, and write a book about it. And so he said, hey, I got this grant. I'm going to come see what you're doing. I'm going to write a book about it. And I said, you're not allowed. I'm not going to let you come to anything they do. So we just blocked him. Like he registered and we said,
did
no.
You really?
Yeah, I didn't, because I just thought, then you will write it as a journalist. You won't write it from the inside. You'll write it from the outside.
Yeah.
He ended up going to one. We had a Sabbath. In those days, we did Sabbath in Minnesota. We did a Sabbath in Nashville. So he ended up going to the one in Minnesota where another guy led it. Dan Walport, a friend of mine, was running one. So Tony Jones went there and figured it out. And he wrote the book. He wrote a book called Soul Something. I don't remember what it was.
Is it Soul Shaper?
Soul what?
Soul Shaper or Sacred Paths or something like that. I've got it up here because I actually took excerpts from his book to use as like just a one sheet kind of half sheet guide for the labyrinth that I have, you know, that we just can put out and people can walk up and they can read it and kind of have an idea of what to do here.
Yeah. So. See, back in the day, if I was in your room, I would have stolen that book by now and burned it. Because I would just say, this is an outsider writing about something he doesn't really know.
I love it.
And then, you know, now I sit in workshops and, you know, I just was at a camp in Texas and this woman was saying, hey, I'm going to teach everybody Lectio Divina. And it was completely wrong. She was like, this is how you come up with great thoughts about God. And this is how you come up with ideas. And I just sit there and go, well,
wow.
It's in God's hands. It's not up to me to be the kingdom monitor. But yeah, I was pretty militant back then.
But you did write a couple books.
I waited as long as I possibly could. And then, So I did that project for 10 years. And then I wrote a book about it. Yeah.
Because I was at the Sabbath in 2001, 2003. And then there was the symposium. It was kind of a gathering of people
that had
participated. It was kind of if I remember right, it was a hybrid. It was a kind of a Sabbath retreat, but then there were people that had actually implemented these practices into their youth ministries.
Yes.
And then they were kind of a panel discussion on how that had gone.
That's right. So, yeah. So I had this project going that was funded by the Lilly Endowment for 10 years, where we actually had churches that were trying to develop a contemplative approach to youth ministry. So it was all grounded in spiritual practices. And those churches, I worked with them for 3 years at a time. Then another set of churches I worked for 3 years at a time. And so, yes, we were highlighting the work they had done and showing, you know, try to show real practical models of how that stuff could look in a real youth ministry.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then there were elements of that, I think, that were in the book Contemplative Youth Ministry.
Yeah, right. So then I wrote a book about all that stuff, all that work, and the teachings we had developed. And in that book, I gave examples from the churches who were integrating it and, you know, basically what we were doing, what a contemplative approach to youth ministry looked like. And that was, you know, but that book was 10 years in the making, you know. I kept notes on that stuff for a long, long, long time. And
sure.
And finally got it out there. And then the other books that I wrote after that were really, you know, they were focused about particular things. So one was about
Growing Souls.
Growing Souls we did with a group of academics, and it was sort of like, what's the theology behind this? What's the thinking and how we formed people? And then we wrote Down Time, which was basically how do you do spiritual practices with young people? And that was my spiritual practices book. And then yep. I woke, then they had me write one that was actually for youth and adults, but that's basically a prayer book.
What's that one called?
Devotional book. It's called Wonder, Fear, and Longing.
Oh.
So it has little reflections and excerpts, but it's more of a personal book. Yeah.
I do have all four of those. And downtime I've used quite a bit in different settings and applied that. I mean I found them helpful. And also to remind me too.
Grandfather, I think those are the only two copies we sold of that book.
I've got collector's items right now.
That's right.
So have you I know you've written other things and articles and stuff. Have you been a part of other book projects or any other things like that that maybe I'm not aware of?
So that drove all that stuff drove my life for up until my late 30s. And then I was asked to work on a project in Southern California to help create a center that would help people become compassionate in a practical way. And this was two friends of mine at Claremont School of Theology. We worked with people who worked in prisons, and I knew how to do spiritual practices. I knew how to do spiritual formation. And so we started trying to figure out what exercises in a real practical way helped a person behave more compassionately in their families and in their work life. So I did that for 5 years. And I wrote sort of out of that. I wrote a book that was a series of stories I use in retreats and in teaching and speaking. And it's called The Gift of Hard Things. And it's stories and then practices that focus on suffering. And so that came out of that work. One of the projects I was asked to do out of that work was to figure out, how do you help a whole town become compassionate? And so I started realizing that sharing stories, telling stories is a natural way to help anybody begin to cultivate compassion. So I developed a community story project, and that's what I've been doing the last 10 years, really. And it's basically, I'm taking all the stuff the church gave me, all the sensibilities and the skills and all the treasures that you really can take from being formed as a Christian minister, and I'm giving them away to the wider community. And I feel like we're in a transition time where the church as we've known it is dying and going back into the ground. Things have a life and then things die. And we're in a death time right now. But and we don't know what the new thing is that's coming. We don't know what the new forms of church or new forms of spiritual community. It's an experimental, playful, creative time, and the new structures aren't here yet. And so I'm trying to steal the gems and the jewels from the church and make them successful, to people as much as I can, see what happens,
So I've mentioned a couple times that I was at National Youth Workers.
Yeah.
In Tampa. And this is the 50th anniversary of YS conventions this year.
Mm-hmm.
Would the first one have been 1969?
I guess if that's what they're saying. Yeah, something like that. So it's early 70s, late 60s, I guess. I thought it was the early 70s. But that might be wrong.
Yeah. And I just wondered, I mean, if that was on your radar, if that was something that was out there that you were aware of, that people were talking to you about.
No,
it was your dad that helped start all this.
Yes. It was a huge part of his life. And so it became a huge part of our life. And as the eldest son, there's nothing, I didn't want anything more than to be a part of that world. I was around youth workers. They were the most living people I encountered. They were just wild, crazy. My dad was the kind of person who, he probably would have been diagnosed with, as ADD or something like that,
Yeah.
He just was a very restless person, and he just wanted to know, where is there life in the room? Where is there something to do? I don't know about his youth specialist thing, but, he was the kind of guy who would go, I should start a radio show. I should get a radio show going in our little town. So he'd get a radio show going. And then he'd say, he'd meet some guy who was funny. He'd say, the two of us should go do live broadcasts, in different, and this is a town of 4,000 people, Yreka, California. So he spent all his time running this radio show for nothing. He's not getting paid. It's just something he wanted to do. He's doing these live broadcasts. then he, you know, there's a television business that was going out of business. He goes, we should buy this television business and run this thing and do youth nights where there's, this is when Pong was coming out and Atari and video game nights and kids could come here after school. So he, you know, he'd do that. And then he's like, I should be on the school board. So he'd get on the school board. You know, he would just, I get exhausted thinking about all the things he was doing. I mean, he just did a ton. Plus he was pastoring a church as a volunteer in our town, plus his speaking business, you know, speaking life, plus youth specialties. So youth specialties, really, particularly in the beginning, I think had a lot of his enthusiastic spirit. And sort of like, you know, the greatest gift from my dad was he was of knowing what is life and what is not life, and really develop a very low tolerance for anything that is not life-giving. And that's the greatest gift I think all of my siblings and I have, is that we can feel when there's life in the room and when there isn't, and we just have a very low tolerance for participating in anything, whether it's our family life or work life or friendships. When things feel fake or false or routinized or deadening in any way, or something that's killing us, you know, like these phones, we just can't abide it very, very long. And so I was in some ways following in his footsteps by trying to do all this spiritual practice and stuff, even though it looked slower and quieter and less noisy. It was very much in the same spirit that my dad was in.
Going where there was life.
Where's the life right now? And if everything becomes noisy and bombastic and commodified, then you got to withdraw into the quieter places.
There's one moment I'm sure I've shared with you at different times, but that at the same time that I'm being introduced to Sabbath practices and contemplative youth ministry, and I'm adopting that into my own life and journey, and then sharing that with youth and youth staff, I'm at one of these YS big conventions, the big whiz bang, and your dad was introducing one of the first nights and telling what was going on. And one of your boys ran up on the stage, and your dad stopped in front of, you know, 3,000 youth workers, because this was back when they were doing three of these across the country, you know, and maybe one in Canada. And he stopped, and he just welcomed his grandson and picked him up and introduced him to everybody and held him in his arms and then kept going. And I thought, that's the kind of leader that, I don't know anything else about him, but just the picture of that moment.
Yeah,
I want to be present like that to my family as I go forward in ministry. And then you just throw on the gasoline of contemplative youth ministry on that for me. And it became who I wanted to strive to be, very imperfectly, in ministry and as a pastor and as a husband and as a father. But that's the moment. That's like, if I was going to write an article about your dad, that's the story I would tell. Yours would be cleaning the toilet. This would be the story with your dad.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. I think that might've been in San Diego. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, it was San Diego.
He got away from us, or my youngest kid. He's like, oh, there's grandpa.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
How old are your kids now?
They just had birthdays. One turned 24, the oldest. And the other one, who you saw on that stage, is now 22, Joseph. And then I have a daughter who's 16. And she was born about a month and a half before my dad died. That's one of the ways I know how long he's been gone, is, you know, her birthday. And now I want to have a surprise guest come in. He's coming to the door right now.
Great. Bring him on.
Did you hear that doorbell?
Oh, are you talking? Yeah, I heard the door. That's my son.
Yeah, I'm talking about your son.
My son's coming. I'm not going to be present to him. I'm totally ignoring him. He has a key. He can figure it out. You know?
Right.
Yeah. No, he's home for the day. Yeah, you did. I wasn't sure if you heard it. I was just going to play it off, but life happens. I have a few other questions here. Just kind of hit them up.
I don't know. I have a feeling that none of this is really relevant. Hopefully you're going to edit this down to like 10 minutes.
You know, what I do is I just kind of listen back to it again, and I just kind of break it up into chunks, and I have a great time. And
if other people, well, good.
people decide to, great. If they don't, then awesome. I'm okay with that. So this is stuff that I want to know. You know, I learned in youth ministry, Mark, to quit planning things like there was going to be a lot of people there, but to plan things like, even if no one shows up, I'm going to have a good time. So that's the philosophy that I take into things, is that at least I'm going to have a good time, even if nobody else decides to show
up. Well, so let me just tell this last story, just because it's fun for me to tell.
Please.
Of my dad. So I think it was the last year of his life, 2002. The San Francisco Giants make it into the World Series. And I'm living, 45 minutes north from San Francisco. I'm at San Francisco Theological Seminary. I'm living on campus there. I'm teaching. I've got a whole week-long event I'm leading. And my dad calls me. He's like, I know this woman who's in charge of extras for any large national event. Like she was in charge of the Academy Awards. If you needed extras, like, you know, they're doing somebody singing a song and they needed 25 people to walk back and forth like they're on a bustling street. She would be the ones who would find the 25 people, dress them up. And she actually would do all the national youth events for the Lutheran Church. She was in charge of all the staging and all that kind of stuff. So she meets my dad, loves him, and says, hey, guess what? You know, the World Series in San Francisco, it's game two. And MasterCard is doing like the greatest moments of baseball of all time. And you had to vote for what you thought your greatest moment in baseball was. And then right before the World Series began, Billy Crystal was going to stand on the field and announce the greatest moments. And it was like Pete Rose sliding to third. And then Pete Rose would come, you know. And part of this whole thing was they had people run onto the field and hold up these giant numbers. And I mean, they were enormous numbers, like almost two stories high. And they would say like number 10, you know, or number 9. And they had live people running and holding these cards and posting them up. So the audience would yell, number 9, the 9th greatest moment of all time. And then it was televised. And my dad says, hey, I can be one of the extras who runs on the field and helps hoist one of these cards. And do you want to do it with me? And I was like, Dad, I'm doing a training. So my dad, like in the middle of his crazy busy life, flies to San Francisco and for 3 days practices like 80 people. They had to dress in all black. They had to practice. And my dad's 60 years old. He's totally out of shape, but he has to run onto the field and then hoist these numbers so that the audience can see him. He practices. And he's calling me like, yeah, we're getting the thing down. We're figuring out how to hoist these numbers. And he calls me the night before. He says, listen, I know you didn't work on the team, but I got the woman, she's going to allow you to be an extra on the field, and you'll be guarding the cables for the televisions when they're filming this thing for the national audience. So I show up on the day of, my dad's super stoked, he's dressed in this black Lycra, and we get these little badges that say the MasterCard top baseball moments, and I stand next to Billy Crystal when he goes out and announces the thing. I'm watching to make sure he doesn't trip over these cords, and they yell number 10. I watch my dad run on the field and work with like 30 other people to hoist these things. And all these baseball legends come on the field and Hank Aaron's family and all this kind of stuff. And then the deal was, they told us, like, we don't have seats for you for the World Series, but your little badge will get you around the stadium. And we had these little badges that said MasterCard. And this is right after 9/11. It's a year after 9/11. So security is tight. Barry Bonds is in the dugout. You got the governor of California there. You got celebrities all over the place. And Dad says, let's just see where we can get with these badges. So we're like trying to walk into the dugouts right before the World Series starts. And we could walk into the dugouts. We're like, listen, we can go to the locker rooms. And we're like showing people our badges. They're letting us in the locker rooms. Then we're like, let's go see if we can like be right where all the press is in the stands, like where all the photographers are to take pictures of the World Series. And they allow us all the way up to the railing. And then we notice there's some guys drinking behind us. And Dad's like, these guys are super annoying. I'm like, yeah. He goes, let's call security and see if security will honor these badges to get these people out of here. So we call security and say, hey, we're with MasterCard. Can you get these guys like to quiet down or move them? They say, absolutely.
Wow.
And so instead of watching the game, we spent the whole time just trying to see what we could do with these badges. That's the kind of idiot that raised me. That's it right there. If you understand that story, that's the whole thing. That's
why I get it.
Finding life. Like, what would be interesting? He's 60 years old. This is how he spends 3 days of his life, you know.
Thank you. Please interrupt me to tell more stories, anything like that. What recharges you, Mark? What do you do to kind of reboot?
Well, you know, the thing is, I'm terrible at that. You know, that's why I'm interested in contemplative practices and all this stuff, because I always have to be brought back to it. Couple things. One is I cook. So usually when I'm totally out of control, I'll say, I need to cook for the day. And I'll cook for a whole day or whole afternoon. Hmm. And I just putter in the kitchen, doing yard work. I garden. I try to get up before most mornings I try to get up before everybody. I start the fire in our pellet stove. I get a book. I make my own coffee. And I sit there and read. So I try to read each morning for at least a half hour, 45 minutes, things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to withdraw. And if I don't, especially my daughter will say, Dad, you need to go take a walk. You know, Dad, go. You need to work outside or something.
Yeah.
Tell when I'm overwhelmed. Yeah.
This reminded me of a conversation I had with one of the other people I interviewed for a podcast. His name is Eric Samuel Tim. You ever heard of that guy or ran into him? He speaks and travels. And he's one of the guys. I know, Eric Samuel Tim. He's one of those guys that, like, while the worship band is playing, he'll do art. And then, like, halfway through, he'll flip it over and you'll realize, oh, that's what it is. And then he finishes
Dumbo.
It. Yeah. Exactly. And we were doing this podcast together, and I asked him how he kept balance in life, and he totally turned it on me and went, well, let me ask you, how do you answer that question? How do you keep balance in life? And I was like, what is he doing? He and I have had some interactions and some good conversations over the last couple of years, but I don't know him super well. And he's in the back of Michael W. Smith's RV outside Texarkana, Texas, and they're doing something that night. And he's like, on the road, and like, he's like, well, tell me how you keep balancing. I'm like, well, why is Eric coming up? And like, and this is what he said. I want to see what you think about this. Cause I responded, and he goes, in your response, I didn't hear you use the word balance once. He's like, I think it's a fallacy. I think it's about faithfulness. I think it's about being faithful to the things that we're, you know, being gifted to us, our relationship with my wife, our relationship with my kids, mm-hmm. the calling that God's placed. And I just wondered, it's really shifted some of my thinking, because I've always kind of strove for balance, and as a good thing, because I feel out of balance all the time. But if I'm working towards it, that means maybe I'm practicing some type of health. I'm getting some type of health. That's the way I've thought about it. But when he just challenged me on that and said, think about it as faithfulness, I was like, oh, but what do you think about that, Mark? Balance versus faithfulness.
Yeah, I think we're always coming up with ideals that are unrealistic and that actually become, you know, demons. And balance is probably one of them. There really is no such thing. I mean, does Jesus look like he's living a balanced life?
Right.
I don't know if that's the word we describe it. So I like words more like, what's life giving, you know, and I like his word about what are you being faithful to? Things like that, because I really don't know. And then for every person has a unique relationship with themselves, with God, with the earth, with other people, and it plays itself out in a unique way. And they're what gives life to each person is different. And we always want to set it up. You know, that's part of getting older. You know, when you're younger, you find these exemplars, these people who seem to embody a certain way of living, and then we try to model ourselves after that. You get older, you learn to accept the weird way you are in the world. and this is how you do it, you know?
Thank you. What's the weirdest thing that's ever happened to you in a ministry context?
Well, I mean, you know, I think in youth ministry, I think a lot of mistakes. I remember, there's a lot of things that happen. I mean, it sort of depends. Like now I go out and lead retreats or I speak. So I'm an itinerant, you know, I'm a stranger. I come in for short amounts of time and then I leave.
Yeah.
So it makes me a safe person. And so it's particularly when I do things in the United Kingdom, it's mostly like people coming up and telling me their deepest pain, you know, or their deepest suffering, or their, or confessing things that they haven't told anybody because I'm an outsider who's only there a short while and leaving. And that's a really, really privileged position. But I know, like, I don't think there's, I've been to the UK, I don't know, 4 or 5 times in the last 4 or 5 years. And each time I'm just crying by the end of the week, you know, because because it's just, it's a privileged position, but it's also like, wow, people really are filled with self-judgment and are sort of just lacerating themselves on the inside all the time. They just don't have no idea how beautiful they are. And so that's a strange thing that I've been experiencing the last 10 years.
Interesting.
You know, yeah. So I'll just leave it at that.
What's the most fascinating place that you've been to? Maybe some place you'd like to go back to, or maybe it's, yeah. So just a place that you've been to and just really loved it there and you want to experience.
Well, I've had these, you know, I've been doing all this community story stuff. And so I've been in, I went and lived in Austin for 6 months with my wife and daughter. Before that, in 2016, I was hired by the Church of Wales, like the Anglican Church of Wales, a diocese up in the north hired me. And these are Welsh speaking people. It was just totally alien to any place I'd been or even knew about. But I had done a series of prayer retreats there, I think in 2015, and they said, we really need you to come back and live here for 6 months and help us, you know, figure out how to do spiritual formation and figure out how to do community outreach through storytelling. And so we lived there, and it was a profound, profound gift. I remember the bishop saying, you have absolute freedom to just go into anything we're doing in terms of any activity, any project, any community, and participate or stand up and speak things or tell us we need to shut things down or tell us we need to start things. Like, he was like, you're like a court jester. Like, I just want you to listen for what God's doing. And so it would be these really humbling, I mean, I don't think I've ever been so nervous, because there would be moments where all the priests of the diocese would be gathered in the cathedral, you know, and the cathedral was, you know, built in the 1100s, and
yeah,
and they'd all be there, and they'd be basically taking their vows as priests, and they'd all be dressed in white, and the bishop would be up on a throne, you know, and I'm not from a high church place, so I feel like I'm in Game of Thrones, you know.
Yeah.
he's got a big golden shepherd's crook, and he's up on this high platform, and I would be sitting among the people, you know, there'd be 600 people in the cathedral watching the priests basically take their vows again for the whole diocese. And all of a sudden the bishop would just say, I was called the missioner in residence.
Really?
And he would say, would the missioner please come to the microphone? And he would say, do you have a word for us? And these are humble people. They're quiet, like being around Midwesterners, you know, they're rural people. They're very quiet. And it would be still. And I remember just like shaking because I knew what I did have a word. I knew what I needed to say. And I remember that first time that happened, I got up to the mic and I just said, you know, your church is dying and it's not your fault. You've done nothing wrong. You've been as faithful as any other generation. You know, God brings things to life, then God takes things back into the ground. And what the suffering is right now is that everyone's grieving, and grief takes on different forms. It looks like resentment. It looks like cynicism. It looks like anger. It looks like apathy. And these things that we're feeling are all coming from a sense of grief and lostness. But I want you to know you've done nothing wrong, and you're faithful people. And that what God really wants us to do at this time to play. It's like that feeling when you leave a funeral and a funeral is the reckoning, where you come out of the funeral going, wow, it's so short. Life could be taken at any moment. How do I want to live? I'm not doing this stuff anymore. I'm going to stop doing that. And it becomes a gift. You know, the funeral, the death of a friend can become a gift because it calls you to what matters. And so I remember those words coming to me and saying it to the group, and just the tears, you know, that were in the room. So that was just this privileged time of other people saying, okay, try to hear what God's saying and be ready to speak it at any moment. And then feeling God move through me at different times and just feeling, well, you know, all those feelings, humbled, worthless in some ways, you know, unworthy, and super loved by the people and by God to get to do that. And then, and just the creativity of God to create a situation like that. That was incredible. And we just felt deeply, man, the people, you know, there's a lot of suffering in the ground there, but it was a gift to be there.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, yeah. You're welcome. I don't know if any of that has anything to do with it.
No, it's good. Well,
I fall into these places within me and then I forget we're on a podcast. So.
No, that's what I'm hoping for. And I don't know if you can see that or read that, but it says missioner.
Oh,
no, see that? You see this?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I might have to send you one of those. This is, I mean, I've read this word. People use this in missiology books. It comes up different ways. People use it, but I always like words that people are used to a little bit, like mission, but then you add something onto it, like ER, and it's missioner. Yeah. And they're like, what is that? And I found in my previous role with working with young adults and missions and in a denomination that they were really uncomfortable thinking about sending missionaries to the U.S. And so if you said missionary, like we send missionaries to other places. We don't send them to the U.S. I'm like, what year are we, like, what gospel are you reading? What year are we living in? And I mean, I understood a little bit about where they were coming from, but I just completely disagree with it. I was like, how do we work around this? And I learned this word missioner. And so I taught this as, do you know Fuzz Keto? Have I talked about Fuzz Keto in Australia, Fuzz and Carolyn Keto?
No.
He taught me this word. It's the first time I heard it. And it was just anybody that's actively seeking to bring about the kingdom of God where they live. Like they're trying to pay attention to what God's doing and joining him. And that's kind of the context, the word, the missioner, was introduced to me. And so then I shared that with youth or young adults or times I've spoken to places just about this is what this word means to me. We're just joining God in what he's doing and paying attention to that and trying not to get in the way of it. Let's be missioners together. So when you said the word missioner and I learned about it and it used in a new way, it really connected with me. But yeah. I taught this to a girl at a mission training camp in 2016, and she is 17. She turned 18. That was in July. In September, she turned 18. And she posts this picture of this tattoo on her leg. And I was like, am I getting in trouble for this somehow? I taught her that word. I didn't tell her to get a tattoo with it, but I think it's really, really cool. And
wow.
And my directive had been, when I was hired for that role, they'd said, we want the mission of God to be tattooed on the hearts of young adults. And I saw that picture and I thought, that's not her heart, but it's pretty close. We need a champion. We need a champion this story. And so we turned it into a t-shirt. And then anyway, it just kind of, I love the word missioner and that you were the missioner at this setting.
Yeah. Up in the North of Wales. Yeah. Yeah. It was great. I love that word too.
Well, let me wrap this up. We've been on for about an hour, my friend.
Yeah. We have more important things to do.
You have way more important things to do, you know, rest and solitude and all those important things. Getting into our days and with our lives and families.
Clean toilets. Yeah.
I'm going to clog a toilet right now. I'm going to call the missioner, my friend Mark Iaconelli, to the microphone and ask if there's anything that you would like to say to someone that is part of a church, a leader in a church, a pastor of a church that might listen to this, one of those three or four people that listen to this podcast. Yeah. and have the missioner just share from their heart something, some just thought or encouragement or what's on your mind for the church today? What's on your heart?
Well, you know, it's what I think I try to do in any conversation with people is just try to encourage them to trust what they know is true, to trust what they know is true, and to let go of the rest. people know what needs to happen in their context, and they know what needs to be let go of, whether in their personal life or in their work life. And the more we trust what we know is life-giving, what we know is true, what we know needs to happen, then the more God works through them. And that's the sadness, is I feel like we've lost our compass in terms of what brings life and what doesn't bring life. Hmm. What's truth and what's not true. And that's all we have to do, you know, is just the truth of who we are, the truth of the needs of the people around us, the truth of who God is. You just stick to your knitting, and you do those small things, and God shows up, you know.
Stick to your knitting.
That's right.
Yeah. I have to dwell on that for a little bit.
There's a lot of knitters now. I was at a coffee shop, and these two people in their 20s, one guy, one girl came in, got coffee, sat down, and they're knitting sweaters together. It's a good spiritual practice.
There you go. I haven't seen that yet. I'll keep my eye out.
Well, things come to Idaho usually about 10 years later.
Right. Yeah. Places. Yeah. I understand.
Yeah.
It will take that long. Actually, my daughter knits sometimes.
See, but, there you go.
Yeah. Well, cool, man. Mark, thanks for taking some time with me. Appreciate it. I always enjoy connecting.
I feel the same. Yeah. I just love who you are in the world, man. I love it. Love it when I see you on Facebook, whatever you're doing. You've been burdened with a bright life. You can feel your spirit across the internet wires.
Wow, man. Thank you. And yeah. Likewise, my brother.
Okay.
All right. Well, enjoy your day. And thank you, man. You too. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Because Church Suite podcast. I hope you were inspired in some way by this episode. Do you have a question for Because or want to partner together to alleviate poverty? Visit us online at becauseinternational.org. Until next time, remember, small things can make a big difference.